And something I love about ketamine, which it helps you feel that. It helps you feel that in a very experiential way of like, oh, this is what it is to house my sensitivity in like a very open, allowing feeling.
Hello, friends. Welcome back to the Evolving Earth podcast, where we speak to creators, entrepreneurs, and visionaries who are creating the world we want to live in. I'm your host, Will Sachs. Welcome back. Let's begin. Hey, friends. Welcome to another episode of Evolving Earth. Man, we are living through a crazy time. And I know myself, I've been struggling with all the emotions that the pandemic and the racially motivated violence, racism, protests in the streets have been bringing up. So I hope you're using this time productively. I've been trying to go inside. I've been trying to call out the fact that we do live in a racist society and call out the fact that those of us who have light skin have a responsibility to do something about it. And so I've been thinking about what my part is in the solution. How do I be part of the solution? And one thing we're doing is our accelerator, Fundraising Mastery. I've declared that we're officially anti-racist, and we've set a goal to enroll more than 50% of our next cohort, founders of color. So that's one thing we're doing, and definitely sitting with it and seeing what else I can do from my position. And then I keep coming back to psychedelics. You know, this series on psychedelic healing is ongoing. I'm not losing interest. I feel like I'm picking up steam. And the reason is because if we can change the way we think and change the nervous system availability that people have, well, then it makes new futures possible. And it makes possible the future of living in a non-racist society, in a society where the color of your skin doesn't mean that you might get gunned down by the people that are sworn to serve and protect. So I keep coming back to it, and I'm going to keep forging ahead with this in the hopes that more people get into these conversations, learn about what's available, learn about psychedelics, and maybe try them and start talking about them to the people in their lives. So onward we go. You know, I loved last week's episode with Marco Chungshu Lam about connecting to the earth. This episode is about ketamine. I've been trying to get somebody on the show, like a luminary in the ketamine space, for a while, and I'm super excited to have Craig Salerno on this episode. Craig helps run the Boulder Wellness Ketamine Collective. Him and a number of therapists came together to create this healing center here in Boulder, which is actually like a mile from my house. And they treat people with ketamine and therapy, and a really beautiful container that Craig addresses in this episode or describes in this episode. So if you don't know anything about ketamine, or if you do know something about ketamine, you'll learn a lot from this episode. We talk about how it works. We talk about the whole process. We also talk a lot about addiction and 12-step work and how psychedelic therapy fits in with that work. And that work has been another discovery of mine going through this process. It's really beautiful. The 12-step stuff is beautiful, in my opinion, and the way that psychedelic healing can augment and help and move people forward is incredible. And Craig tells a few stories about his experiences of seeing people go through that kind of transformation. So Craig is the former clinical director at North Star Transitions, which is an inpatient and outpatient treatment program. So he's got a decade of experience with addiction. And he also works in private practice, offering psychotherapy and psychedelic integration services and ketamine therapy for addiction, depression, anxiety. So I hope you enjoy this conversation with Craig as much as I do, and we'll see you on the other side. Hey, friends. This episode is brought to you by Fundraising Mastery, which is our accelerator program that we run a few times a year for mission-driven entrepreneurs to help them raise money. So we've set a goal for this cohort to enroll at least 50% founders of color into this cohort that's launching in July. So if you know anybody who might be a good fit or somebody who's creating something and they're raising money, please refer them to foundersgetfunded.com and we'll do a call with them and see if it's a match. Our goal is to help 100 entrepreneurs get funded over the next year. So we're accelerating the program right now. And the reason this is important to me, especially with what's going on globally, is, you know, we look at the world and we think about what are the solutions. And I believe that a big part of those solutions are going to be created by entrepreneurs. People are going to have ideas for how to make the world better, and then they're going to go out and create organizations and companies that help to enact that change. And I love that power of entrepreneurship, and I want to help it flourish. So again, that's foundersgetfunded.com. If you know anybody who might be able to benefit from the program, please send them there. Many thanks. Craig, welcome to Evolving Earth.
Good to see you, Will. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I remember when we talked just a few weeks ago and there was just a pandemic, you know. We were talking just before we hit record here that, man, how things have changed and continue to change.
Yeah, it's kind of unbelievable the amount that is moving. I'm seeing some clients every other week currently, and it's just kind of unbelievable how quickly things move. And I mean, it's like almost a different landscape. Each time I connect with people, it's a lot of rapid movement.
Rapid movement.
Yeah.
And when we talked before, you said something that has impacted me and stuck with me, that you said that you enjoy looking at what's happening right now as an altered state or as a ceremony. Like, we're all in this altered state, and that is being a useful frame to perhaps understand and deal with it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it mimics ceremony in such a powerful way to me, of almost like this catalyzing event, which could be very comparable to consuming a medicine or whatever it is that is done in ceremony. And then just this rapid movement and shift, the exposure to the shadow and just the panic and intensity, but also like the profundity that comes with that. And I think often the question of like, how long is this going to be? Am I stuck in this forever?
Totally.
Will life be the same on the other side? I mean, I feel so much of that in my body personally. So yeah, ceremony, definitely.
And what lessons from ceremony and medicine work do you think that we can apply to deal with the pandemic, the protests, the police violence?
Yeah, well, one thing I really appreciated that happened in a Shipibo ceremony is, as you know, there's like a lot of lulling into visual states in the ayahuasca work. And I remember seeing a shaman come up to a participant who was to my left and almost like snap him awake of, don't be lulled by the visual and the intensity. Stay conscious, stay awake, stay present. Feel your butt on the floor. And something about that of like, really keep your eyes open. And there's so many places to be distracted and pulled. And something about holding center, keeping your eyes open, witnessing, and also just keeping the work internal. I think that's such a beautiful way to kind of view this process.
Don't like get up screaming, run out of the run out of the maloka and into the jungle naked.
Yeah. Don't go seek the jaguar spirit outside totally. Of the jungle. Yeah, but there's also this idea of just like using the breath, you know, and like allowing intensity, inviting intensity, but using the breath to really regulate and come back to oneself. And feels like a big piece to hold, at least the way I'm noticing. I'm being pulled in so many directions and feeling inspired and then feeling agitated and just like, okay, where's the breath here? Like, okay, working with it, you know, feeling the heart, feeling the ground. It's been a powerful practice and a hard practice.
Yeah. Sage advice. I know I've been struck with the protests and the violence that's going on all over the United States, and finding myself watching, like really watching YouTube and watching interviews with people of color and leaders from those communities, and watching police violence and wanting to do something, because I do believe personally that there's the crime of apathy or the offense of inaction for those of us who have white privilege. I'm trying to come to something, the answer to the question of what can I do? Mm-hmm. And yeah, I'm wondering, how has this been impacting you and your practice and the people that you're working with?
Yeah. I mean, I'm grappling with the same question of just seeing so much and feeling so much, and then just wondering, where is my entrance point, you know, with the energy I feel and some of the disgust I feel. I mean, there's just so many emotions that are fueling the desire for action.
Yeah.
And then just this idea of like, what is wise action right now? And for me, a lot of it, I think this is the pleasure of being a therapist, I think, is assisting people and how much that helps me to find their entrance point. All right, where are the feelings? What are they most aligned to? Where do I feel the most inspiration and motivation to do something? And what can I actually do that's practical and applicable? And to me, it takes a little internal contemplation to find what is most enlivening and then just really moving from that space. And for me, it's always working with people and helping people wake up and feel more, do more.
Yeah.
So at least for me, that feels like the big piece that's come to me of like, okay, be present in this, support people in this waking up process, you know, help direct and provide some guidance as I can. And yeah, it's been powerful working with clients in this way too. I mean, I would say 90% of my clients have really abandoned their personal narrative, and the narrative has moved much beyond into community and being an ally. And what a beautiful thing to watch that extension outward.
Yeah, right. I feel that too. I mean, that seems like the silver lining here is it's having us think about the collective and where we're all headed. Because when stuff starts to hit the fan, like it is now, you start to think, wow, like we're really all so connected, and which way is this going to go?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had a client say, he's like, my own anxiety feels suddenly less important. You know, like working with my anxiety day to day feels not as alarming as it did before the world kind of came open and alive.
Yeah. I was telling you before that I was reading this book, The Way of the Psychonaut, Stan Grof's Encyclopedia for Inner Journeys, this morning. And he's got, this chapter has been calling to me because he's got chapter 12 is The Roots of Human Violence and Greed. Mm. And I've been watching as people that I really respect seem to have be changing or doing things that are surprising me, like acting in ways that are either more violent or more opinionated or more tied to what I consider conspiracy theories. And what Stan says in this book is that inside of us, there's all these emotions around violence and greed that come from our birth trauma, the trauma of our lives, or even transpersonal trauma. And that stuff just bubbles up sometimes. Yeah. And it becomes this collective madness that then goes through a cycle of violence or war and then integration, and it goes over time. And this for me is helping me understand like what's going on right now, why these police officers are beating up peaceful protesters and why people are, you know, burning down buildings in cities. And so I'm curious what your thoughts on that are, like from your perspective as a therapist working with these issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I love that you're reading that. And yeah, it's such a bizarre thing to watch how people shift their roles so quickly, and all of a sudden you have the anger and the violence that can emit out of someone that maybe has felt quite neutral to you, and then all of a sudden they're enraged, and it's like a shock. I think a lot, I think it's called the Stanford Prison Studies. These were done back in the day where you give someone a role to like oversee a bunch of fake prisoners, and within 3-4 days they're enacting harm, they're actually making contact with the fake prisoners. And just this idea of like when you take a role and you have a sense of permission to act out, suddenly humanity can get pretty scary. And I always think in the Tibetan world, they say klesha, destructive emotions, need an object. And I think there's so many intense emotions alive right now. And I think people are doing whatever they can to kind of express and emote. And the unfortunate thing is a lot of people will take the first quickest thing, which might be social media, to purge some of their anger and aggression. It might be actually being physically, you know, engaging in altercations, but the mindfulness it takes to actually feel and stay with the feeling versus purge it or, you know, find a way to act it out.
Yeah.
That's what I feel like I'm seeing. It's just like these quick impulsive ways to move emotions and to tolerate emotions. And often I think they can be pretty infantile and aggressive. So reminds me of like a kid hitting another child when they get their toy taken away. It's like the first impulse can be very violent.
Yeah.
And the mindfulness it takes to actually stay with the emotion and say, oh wow, there's a lot of anger and aggression here. What do I want to do with this? Takes quite a bit of mindfulness to stay in there.
Yeah. And it's kind of opened my eyes to, or changed my perspective, because up till now I've had this probably privileged belief that, oh, people are going to act rationally. Like we're not going to have a revolution or a war here in the United States or Canada. But then seeing how people are reacting, like, I don't think we're close to that now, but just seeing how people, the whole expression of emotion and the scapegoating builds on itself, it's kind of changing my view and having me see, oh, this is how we head towards war, is these unintegrated emotions get amplified. Their scapegoats get identified and then off we go.
Yeah. And then the group power, once you know, one behavior gets normalized, the next person feels invited to do it. And I feel like that revving up process is kind of terrifying.
Yeah.
But it's funny because to me, I'm like, individuals feel a little bit more predictable when you sit with someone alone and you're helping them work through stuff. They could use a little bit more conscious energy. And then you put people in groups. And for some reason, I think people really acclimate to like the most antisocial behavior can sometimes set the norm. And it's a fascinating and scary thing to witness. And that's a lot, I think, of the looting and the intensity with that, with the riots, even within the police grounds, them exhibiting violent behavior and how it can set a norm, that is really terrifying to me.
Yeah. So therapy for everybody.
Therapy for everybody. Yeah. Well, and I just keep thinking too, the power of group work with really mindful, intelligent leaders to be able to help people as a group acclimate to the highest kind of like behavior norm and actually really encourage people to like do the work it takes to get there as a group. That feels really important.
Yeah. Do you do that kind of work? Do you do group therapy?
Yeah, I do group. So a lot of my experiences have been in group with substance abuse and addiction, which, I mean, it feels comparable in a way in the sense that everyone's in like a very acute state when I see them. Their early recovery, all the defenses have been let go of. So it is just, it can be complete anarchy and just trying to help people regulate through that. It's really hard work. It's energetic work. But
I would love to talk about that some more because that feels like a great segue. So I've become obsessed with 12-step work in the last 6 months. It's something that I'm delving into daily. And the reason is because this series on psychedelic healing, it's felt like it's opened up a Pandora's box or opened up access to emotions that I didn't have access to before. Mm-hmm. And now I'm trying to do the integration of, well, what do I do with these? How do I deal with these? And it turns out that the 12-step process and all the groups and books and everything have figured out a map. Like there's a map for how this goes. And you mentioned early recovery. Early recovery is when all the emotions bubble up and that you haven't felt for your whole life and you've stuffed them down and then you have to somehow deal with them.
Yeah, and reorganize.
Reorganize, let go of all the defense mechanisms and structures that kept you from feeling those emotions and integrate a new version of yourself. And it's incredible and beautiful and I want everybody to know about it.
Yeah, I always say that it's a bummer that the 12 steps is so localized to addiction work because I feel like the 12-step model itself is just such a powerful, yeah, it's like a death rebirth process of like, how can we let go of parts that are no longer serving us with the invitation to embody a new self? And I'm like, I think we all need that. It's like a rite of passage. I feel like the 12-step is a rite of passage.
It feels like a rite of passage, right? Your personality is in adolescence or in childhood is a collection of coping and defense mechanisms based on your family of origin. And then at some point we should have a celebration where you let go of all that and you reclaim your true self.
Absolutely. Yeah. And thinking when you're developing these patterns as an adolescent, your brain isn't fully developed. You haven't been exposed to the kinds of tools that you would like to use. You are just using what is available. Yeah. And how often we carry those into our 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s and beyond. Yeah. With no invitation of like, hey, here's a time where we can really purge and let go of some of these non-serving behaviors. That's why I love the recovery process and where I think there's like a wisdom to having become addicted and needing to get out of it. It is a moment where you absolutely need to let a part of yourself die. And it's scary. It's terrifying. It's really hard. And people get really lost in it and people pass away in that process, which is terrifying and scary. And when you move through that, you create superheroes on the other side, which is why I love addiction work, particularly when you move through that 12-step process or move through a therapeutic journey where you let go and you re-embody a new self. It is an unbelievable thing to witness. And those are the leaders we need on the other side. The people who have done this like depth, powerful work of knowing what it is to let go and re-embody. Those are the people we need in leadership.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It should be like a requirement almost.
Totally. The compassion you have on the other side for someone who's stuck and people who are engaging and enacting aggressive, rude coping behaviors. I mean, you just did that process. You know what it is to be there and to transition through. So I think it actually opens the heart a lot.
I'm not through it yet.
Yeah. Still riding.
I'm on step 4.
Yeah. Oh, that's hard.
That's the hardest one. I've been avoiding it. And yeah, this weekend I'm planning to sit down and just do it.
Yeah. This is like the resentments and what's your piece. Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to talk about hard work.
Woo. Yeah.
I get chills even thinking about that step. Yeah.
Yeah. So can you tell us more about how you see addiction and what it is and the process of moving through and like, to be clear, from my perspective, I think it's the rare human that doesn't have some addiction.
Agreed. Yeah. I mean, I really relate to Gabor Mate kind of says like everybody's on the scale somewhere and it's just a matter of where you land and what the behaviors are that become compulsive or addictive. I work primarily with substance abuse, which I would say if there's a scale of intensity, it's pretty far on the intense side, mainly because of the physiological impact and the spiritual impact. I mean, there's just so much negative repercussions that come from substance use. But the way I see it, yeah, it's kind of this combination of doing whatever it takes in terms of coping to deal with suffering, most likely coming from early trauma, and just learning to regulate a nervous system. And you just tend to pick techniques that are not helpful. Some of those are substance abuse related. But then when you add substances, it creates like a very compulsive, energetic loop that is very hard and difficult to stop. And it creates intense momentum. And that's where I think addiction work becomes really hard, as you are working with a snowball that's been moving quite intensely and can try as best you can to halt it. But it creates a mind of its own, and it's quite compulsive and intense. So it's kind of how I see addiction, which is why I love psychedelic medicines. If you want to talk about something that has like a potency and power with stopping compulsive energy and like initiating contemplation and a stop and a wake up, I think psychedelics do that in a nutshell. And like, what a powerful medicine to bring into addiction.
Yeah. Well, yeah, let's talk about ketamine. So I had Rick Doblin on the show, and we talked about MDMA and Dr. Hannah McLean. And then we had Dennis McKenna talking about mushrooms and DMT, and Dr. Joe talking about ayahuasca. But I haven't talked about ketamine at all. And I've been really looking forward to this interview, because having had my own experiences with ketamine, it's incredible stuff and very different than everything else. Yeah. So just for the benefit of anybody who might not be familiar with it, can you give a little overview of maybe a history of what is this stuff?
Yeah. It's funny. It's kind of like, it's been around for a while, but it feels like the new kid on the block in terms of the psychedelics. I think a lot of people know the classics, and then ketamine is like just kind of coming in therapeutically as a psychedelic, but it's a dissociative anesthetic. So often used in hospitals for helping people manage pain through surgery. And there was a curious thing that kept happening, which is that when people would go under, they would talk about these intense visual spiritual experiences they had and these ego deaths. And they would just call, oh, that's a side effect of the medicine. Until someone was like, wait a second, maybe this isn't a side effect. Maybe this is a potent effect of the medicine. So that kind of opened the door to ketamine being viewed as a psychedelic. And now these like sub anesthetic doses, so we're not putting people under, but we're kind of using enough ketamine that it's disconnecting one from the alarm systems of the body and really letting consciousness open. It just opens up a lot of visual experience, a lot of spiritual experience. It induces a lot of insight, and it's just become a very powerful therapeutic tool. And one of the best parts about it, it's a Schedule 3 substance. It's legal to use therapeutically. It can be written off-label for treatment-resistant depression. So it's really a tool we have versus the MDMAs, the psilocybins, which are still in clinical trial. Ketamine's available. We can use it. It's a pretty safe medicine, pretty predictable in terms of how it works with people and the timing. So yeah, it's been an incredible tool.
And how did you first get introduced?
It's funny because my vision and understanding of ketamine growing up in New Jersey was like the K-hole. It's like, oh, that's like a terrifying.
Me too.
Yeah, it's a terrifying drug that like puts you in a K-hole. You're going to be unconscious and it's going to be a terrible, bad trip. So probably in my mid-20s, that's really how I understood ketamine. But I had done some reading about John C. Lilly, who was working with intramuscular ketamine, and him talking about the depths of experience that come with that use of ketamine. So that kind of opened it up a little bit. And then luckily got to see Dr. Phil Wolfson and read about his work with ketamine-assisted therapy and attended one of his trainings. And that's really what blew me open. Got to do my own personal experience with ketamine. And I was like, oh, wow, this is an unbelievable medicine and very potent, very powerful. So it's a pretty new one to me as well. I mean, within the last 2 years, it's really come into my frame and proven to be quite effective therapeutically. So personally and with my clients. So
do you want to tell the story of that first experience or what you got from that? Is that?
Sure. Yeah. Well, it's funny because I always bring in some preconceived notions. So as I said, the K-hole experience, I was imagining dark, scary, stuck. You know, I'm like, what is this going to do? But it was just like this immensely opening, I don't even know how to describe it, like cool, calm, neutral, loving energy just overtook my body. I remember being deeply visual and just, I mean, I remember like giggling of like, oh, wow, this is so soft. This is so gentle, you know, and the invitation were like, oh, what a beautiful experience to be human. This feeling is like so sweet and comfortable. And it just, I mean, it felt just like being covered in a nice warm blanket. And in that, the ability to contemplate and to go into some spaces that feel challenging, and being like, wow, I could meander through some content that feels really difficult for me, but I can think about early experiences that felt really painful to me with like kind of this neutral, calm, loving energy. And that's where I really noticed the potency of like, oh, this really opens a door for you to move through really difficult things with a whole new holding container that's way softer, way gentler, way more inviting. So that was, yeah, my first experience with it.
And was this a dose that you were non-communicative, like closed eyes?
No, this is like a much lower dose. We worked with lozenges, which there's a couple different ways we work with the medicine. We do lozenges, which is like a tablet you'll put in your mouth, you'll let it dissolve for 12 minutes, swish it around, and it tends to be, we call it trance dosing. So this is lower, you'll be kind of in contact with the therapist staying in the room. You'll have visual experience, somatic experience, but you are not off to the moon. The intramuscular doses, particularly with the higher doses at, I mean, it is a complete ego death. You will be, William might not be a thing for a while. With this dose, my first experience was a pretty low dose lozenge dose, and it was, yeah, really beautiful and really sweet, really gentle. Hour and a half up, 30 minutes down, pretty predictable, pretty safe, and it was beautiful.
Beautiful. So is that like 75 milligrams or something like that?
Yeah, I think I did 125 my first experience.
Okay. But because it's a lozenge, it's different than taking it other ways.
Yeah, you're actually taking less of the medicine. So I think you take 125, you'll probably get 25% of the medicine actually absorbing versus the intramuscular injection is pretty immediate, pretty rapid.
So it sounds like there's two different kinds of experiences. One with the lozenge, which is more gentle and where you're in a trance kind of state and you can talk with the therapist or whomever. And then the intramuscular dose is the ego death, like you said, the big guns.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. And we like to start with these trance doses. The trance doses are really good too for people that are actually utilizing the ketamine to process trauma. So let's say you come in with PTSD and there's just like a lot of defenses around working with trauma. And that can be anxiety, fear, you know, restriction. I want to access and talk about things that are challenging. It just doesn't feel as available to me. Or when I do talk about it, I can't access the feelings. These like lower dose, pretty much what ketamine is doing, working with the glutamate system, turning off the panic buttons. So those high intensity defenses that kind of lock us up, you can just imagine they settle, which gives us the ability to really move in as a therapist and say like, okay, let's really move towards the things that feel scary. All of a sudden the defenses are lowered and people can just really move through content in a much smoother, safer way, which is really the brilliance of the lower dose. And then I think as we maneuver and kind of do, I call it the cleanup work, you know, like really working through some of the trauma, reorganizing, usually people 4 sessions, 5 sessions in, we do the higher doses, which is to initiate a lot more spiritual experience and the kind of that bigger overarching scaffolding of understanding the trauma in a spiritual sense. And I think that's where the IM doses have very important potency.
Got it. And what kind of doses are those IM doses?
In terms of milligrams?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're looking, usually starting people around 65, taking them up to as high as 125.
Got it. Yeah. And how long does that kind of experience last? Is it just one injection and then?
People do it differently. Yeah, I think the nurse and the doctor I work with, they'll administer it twice in a session. But I think the ideal for me, at least how I like to work, is a single dose right off the bat and just trust you're going to get the experience that you need. But if we go higher dose, they're usually just doing a single dose right in the start. And it's about an hour up and down.
Yeah. So it's a 2-hour intense experience.
Yeah. And we do it very therapeutically. So it's usually orienting and setting intentions in the start, really building the rapport with the therapist and, you know, organizing the compass. Where do we want to go? What are we expecting? What might we find in the way? Doing the experience and then really focusing on processing on the back end and debriefing and giving people space to talk about what came up, what they saw, what they felt.
Yeah.
Yeah. So usually my sessions are usually around 2.5 to 3 hours total, but the actual medicine, the deep part of the medicine work is probably an hour.
Yeah. Incredible. I can't wait to try it.
Yeah. Wait, so you said you did have some ketamine experience or no?
I have, but never with the lozenge and never intramuscularly.
You did the infusions, the IV infusions?
No. Insulfated.
Okay, gotcha. So many different ways to ingest the medicine, and they all have very different experiences, which is interesting as well.
Yeah, it seems unique. So at the Boulder Wellness Ketamine Clinic or Collective, which is like 2 miles from my house here in Gum Barrel, can you tell us a little bit about how that came together and the intention behind it and the work that you guys are doing?
Sure. Yeah. So a group of us had trained with Dr. Phil Wolfson and Julaine Andrews with the Ketamine Training Center. We knew this was a very important thing to bring into the community. So a group of us had kind of organized and said, like, let's find a shared space to really promote this work and bring ketamine therapy to this region. So we all just got together and just sat and said, like, how can we do this in a way that is integritous? I mean, psychedelic medicines right now are booming. There's a lot of people working underground and doing very interesting work in that way. We really want to work as licensed people, licensed clinicians, medical providers, and doing it in a way that's really targeting people with treatment-resistant depression, post-traumatic stress, trauma. Those are really the people we want to focus on. So we just found a space together. It's a family nurse, doctor, MD, and then five therapists. And we kind of share resources and we, you know, intake people, find who's going to be the perfect fit. And that's kind of what it looks like. But
so you said addiction, which we already talked about, depression, and trauma. So I love asking people this question, like, what is your understanding of depression? What is it in your opinion? Because so many people, there's a lot of different opinions.
Yeah, it's curious. I mean, I think my opinions about it change so often, but I imagine I always think somatically. So much activation, so much sensitivity, the body buzzes, you know, and you can deal with a lot of anxiety, but there's a certain point where that state is no longer operable and the system goes downward. Pew. And I think, the body's really intelligent in the sense of like, this is too much noise, this is too much data, so let's drop in. And I view depression as kind of like this locked, internalized state where there's a lot of emotional weight, a lot of things that need processing, but it's really guarded and held. And that's why things feel really saturated, heavy, low motivation, because the energy source has been muted. So a lot of depression for me is just like finding the ways to move the activation and actually get the system churning again, which usually has to do with processing a lot of the stuff that's been
locked down.
Yeah.
So someone comes in and says, I'm depressed, or I don't feel the joy of life. And they come to the ketamine clinic. Is it like a few sessions with the lozenges and then the IM and over a period of a couple months, or what's the protocol that you would recommend?
Yeah. I mean, usually what we do is we always start with individual psychotherapy and see if we can get things moving that way. I mean, just relationship, I believe, is so healing. So a lot can actually shift just by coming in with the dedication and willingness to start doing the work. So really, we meet it that way first. We'll do a series of prep psychotherapy sessions, really exploring someone's history, what their depression feels like, because everybody has kind of a different experience and flavor of what depression feels like for them. And as a therapist, we're just kind of attuning to that process, seeing what people are feeling, seeing if we can get things moving without the medicine on board. And if we do move into the ketamine work, yeah, we usually initiate, we call it the six pack, a six series of ketamine sessions. So you're usually doing two a week, probably for 4 weeks. And we start lozenge first two, lozenge next two, and then we move to the IM doses when it feels appropriate.
Wait, two a week for 4 weeks is eight, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, we usually do 6 to 8 sessions. Nice thing about the ketamine is we're checking in along the whole way and just saying, where are we at? And once we notice things are really becoming relieved, we'll shift to integration psychotherapy and actually keep the medicine on the sideline. We really want to use it as a tool and not as, you know, the magic pill, the magic fix.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's really a tool to help the work get done. But I mean, if things start shifting and moving, we'll actually put the ketamine to the side and just focus on integration therapy as well.
And then can you tell us a little bit about, like you were telling me before when we talked, some of the results that you, like some of the things that you see happening?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, I think the nice stuff for me, so I'm really passionate about bringing this into the addiction field. I've worked in, I mean, over 10 years in kind of this conventional treatment model for addiction, which is inpatient residential and then doing 3 months of intensive outpatient, and the relapse rates are through the roof. I mean, it's just not a very effective model. So I've been really interested in bringing ketamine work to people that are in early recovery and these kind of initial month to 2 months in early recovery, which usually is where people fall, utilizing the ketamine to help them move out of that and do some of the deep processing. And I've seen incredible results with that thus far. I mean, we're 4 for 4 with working with people specifically with alcohol addiction, people that come in drinking 750 milliliters of vodka a day, throwing up blood, intense withdrawal. We'll get them sober for 2 days or send them out to a detox, initiate the ketamine work. And so far, 4 for 4, it's been immediate abstinence. I mean, I have someone who's 9 months into recovery, another who's 6 months. I mean, these are people that are doing very powerful work. And if you track people trying to work through addiction, it's not very often that you see kind of this linear growth out of the initial attempt at sobriety. Usually it's kind of this rocky up and down. And so far, I'm just so impressed with people's ability to process and find recovery through the ketamine work. And yeah, it's been unbelievable. So wow. those are huge. And then we had an eating disorder primary client we just worked with, another just incredible rapid shift. I don't even know how to describe it. Just like a new human pops out on the other side. And that was a 6 series of ketamine. We did some prep work. This was someone with some binging and purging, but also a lot of anger and aggression underneath, and just the openness and allowance to work with a lot of that. And now it's become like this very, it's become a superpower. The feelings and the things that were underneath and that were being coped with now are like equipped as potent weapons in the world in a good way, you know? And just seeing that opening is just unbelievable.
I think it's, Katie told me this, but I think it came from Gabor Mate originally, was that the most sensitive among us are the people that are most likely to develop addictions, because sensitivity by definition means a larger reaction to outside stimulus. And so sensitive people have more, potentially more of an emotional response to what's happening, more of an overload, like you said, that then could drive somebody to try and cope with that pain.
Absolutely. And
so it sounds like this person that you had is a living example of that.
Yeah, I would say most of the people I work with in any addiction, and I consider eating disorder within kind of that realm of like addictive, compulsive, it's highly sensitive people that are deeply attuned and deeply resonant with the world and feel a lot and see a lot and take in a lot of data, and they are just finding creative ways to manage themselves and a culture that strongly encourages people to tune out and tap out in whatever way possible. I don't know if you were about to say that, but
I was, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So we have a culture that doesn't welcome emotions in large part, like trying to think of when I saw a politician cry or get emotional. It's very much against this. It's a sign of weakness in our culture.
Absolutely. Yeah. And yeah. That's, I think the nice thing is watching people reorganize that core belief that the sensitivity is an issue, and how many people have the informing of other people telling them that. And then when you can start shedding some of those old core beliefs of being told you're too much, you feel too much, you should be stronger, and instead saying like, wow, these are actually superpowers to be sensitive and to be attuned in this way. And actually what I need to do is learn how to increase my window of tolerance to be with this. And then once I can do that, holy shit, I have like an arsenal of deep attunement and ability to be in deep relationship. That to me is just a beautiful thing when that tolerance for the sensitivity is built. Yeah. And something I love about ketamine, which it helps you feel that. It helps you feel that in a very experiential way of like, oh, this is what it is to house my sensitivity in like a very open, allowing feeling.
Because of like the warm blanket that you were describing.
Yeah, yeah. Just without these walls of like hitting the buttons where it's like, oh, too much, too much. The ketamine's like, okay, what if we just allow all of it? You know, and just feeling like, oh my goodness, this feels incredible. And this is possible to hold this. So just that experiential reference, the body doesn't forget that. And then I think that's where integration therapy comes in, is like, how do we really embody that in a way that's sustainable and long-term?
It sounds like ketamine and meditation could be a good mix.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I always feel like, yeah, I feel like all the psychedelic medicines eventually, if you want to graduate to the ultimate psychedelic, it's meditation.
Totally.
The good thing about the psychedelics is like, they're not subtle, you know?
Right.
They'll walk you right to the spaces you need to go. Meditation can be an arduous process.
Yes. That's been my experience. Is there was years of doing it where now when I look back, I feel like I was disembodied, and now I'm starting to feel things when I meditate in my body. And sometimes I'll cry or get overwhelmed with emotion. And I'm starting to welcome that, because it feels like the process that you were just describing of increasing my capacity to feel things.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like your window has opened wider. So a lot more feelings when you're sitting.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then to me, I'm like, I think of the body naturally. It knows how to release. It knows how to move things. So as the window stays open and you even deal with the sensitivity and the intensity, it will wash, and learning how to trust the body to do that. Yeah. With the tears or the shaking or the yawning. And as you know, from ayahuasca ceremony, the body's like very clever with how it lets go of data and lets go of intensity.
Yeah. Yeah. I wish someone had told me. I mean, people say you can only feel joy to the extent that you can feel pain, and that it's the same spectrum. And so this rite of passage that we were talking about, the key information for somebody going through that seems to be, there's all these hard to feel feelings that are in there. And after you let them out, you'll have greater capacity to feel the joyful feelings. Because the prospect of just going in and feeling all that stored away frustration or pain or helplessness or whatever it is. It's not very attractive unless there's like a payoff, you know?
It's true. Yeah. It's like, for what?
Why would I do that?
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I heard you say in the beginning that you wish someone like taught you. Yeah. I'm like, that's culturally, I wish there was an invitation of like, yeah, feel it, feel the intensity, even thinking of what our world is doing right now and the anger and the aggression that's getting so much judgment. I have a sense of like, yeah, let's feel revolted. There's a lot to feel revolted about, and it needs to move. It definitely needs to move. Yeah. I wish we had more invitation to go into those.
Totally. Yeah. And it feels like it is moving. Like there's legislation being proposed. Minneapolis police force they're talking about disbanding the police force and doing something different. It reminds me of some of these proposals remind me of the harm reduction that exists at Burning Man or exists in other communities where you've got the police, but you also have a community force or a concept of a community policing where at Burning Man, they have rangers and if something is going wrong, you go to the ranger who's just another member of the community to see if you can sort it out. And if you can't, then you go to the police.
Yeah. But there's community contact first and trying to get it done within the group context. Yeah,
exactly.
It's beautiful. I've never been to Burning Man, but these ideas sound lovely. And it just proof there's another way.
There's another way, and I've experienced it. And the police at Burning Man are overwhelmingly a negative force in my experience. Mm. You know, they're like taking people's cars and searching them and arresting them for marijuana and things that are legal in the states where these people come from. And so anyways, I like the idea of experiencing all the emotions that are coming up and sitting with them and using them as a force for change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Revulsion. We have this statement in therapy, which is like revulsion is a great sign, you know, like as you start to witness even things that you, and when we're talking about the rite of passage, the things that are no longer serving and you feel that like, ugh, like, no, we can't do this anymore. It's such a sign of healing. Mm. And then also like you want to talk about depression and getting out of depression, the anger and agitation, it's energy. It's energy that might be very valuable. Of like, oh, I can't do this anymore. I'm so fucking stuck. All that is beautiful. It's energy in the body and it wants to move. And just the ability to create a space for that and say like, yes. You know, that to me is it's where I get passionate about the work.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Right. Because it's like the first stage of recovery is denial or addiction or whatever. There's like some denial about, at some point I realized I was probably a workaholic when I was running Kindara. Like I was working 60 hours a week and then at some point I have to come out of denial and say, okay, what was that about? Mm. There's something underneath there.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the bravery it takes to ask that question. I mean, I love even why was I doing that? What was going on? And being curious as opposed to judgmental or self-aggressive of like, yeah, let's like really explore this. What was going on in there? You know, what were the impacts? Yeah. Those questions are so valuable.
Yeah. So it's like denial is the first step. And then the revulsion comes when we become aware of our own denial and how we've actually been operating or whether it's workaholic or eating too much sugar, which are kind of two of my life experiences to date. And then healing can happen.
Mm. Yeah, but you need to turn the lights on first. And then you see it and you're like, oh, shit. Oh, boy. What's in the basement? Oh, shit. Okay.
I got to deal with that now.
Yeah. We got to work with this. But then, I'm like that. That's, I think, where it's so good to have a healer and a therapist or a support person on board to like really help acclimate to the woe. Like, okay, this is why I was doing this. Oh my goodness. This is related to past trauma. Or this is related to compulsion. Oh shit. You know, you need someone to hold on to in those moments. And it's like, okay, let's take a breath. There's ways to heal through this.
Right. Because if you could deal with it on your own, we probably would. But that's where the denial comes because the overwhelm is to such a degree that it's above our capacity. That's what I'm coming to understand.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, how often do we turn on the light, see everything and say like, oh. nope, that's a lot. That's too much.
Yeah. Yeah. So the healing and community piece of having a therapist and having a structure and being able to surrender to wisdom outside ourselves.
Totally. Yeah. And I don't even mean to just place it on therapists. I even think romantic partners, just people that are like open to this idea of like we heal through bravery and through seeing and bringing awareness. But then also it's not just awareness that sets us free. It's like seeing and then knowing intelligently how to move with what we see and just whoever it is that helps us say like, yeah, I'm in this with you. I think that's such a powerful part of the process.
Mm. You talk in one of your articles, or actually before I asked that, you said addiction, depression, and trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And are you talking about any kind of trauma, like, or major traumas like car accidents, PTSD, or?
Yeah, we always say like the little T traumas and the big T traumas. Little T traumas just being anywhere that your nervous system has been overloaded to a point where it couldn't work with the external stimuli successfully. And that will create an impact in the body and potentially symptoms, but then also complex trauma, which is people who have felt that experience over a prolonged amount of time, in which case the nervous system really learns to be pretty doubtful and untrusting of the external environment, could be really self-protective. We work with both levels of trauma, and I would say a little bit more passionate about complex trauma, which is, I think, where the psychedelic medicines really do powerful work. Again, giving that giving a wider window of tolerance to really move through, you know, successive traumatic histories and things like that.
What about people who have a more of a little T trauma?
Mm-hmm. All of us.
Asking for a friend, right?
Yeah. No, I think it's great. I think it's great for that too. Yeah. There's a great book. I forget who wrote it. It's called The Trauma of Everyday Life. We're all just enduring, particularly right now. You think anyone's ready for this level of intensity and stress? No way. I mean, I feel burnt out. I consider myself a pretty resourced individual. And there's days where I'm like, wow, this is way beyond what I can take today. And like seeing the news and witnessing police, like my body is losing its ability to regulate. I mean, I'm feeling that every day. And
me too, this week.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, those, I would even say that's moving towards, I don't know, not higher case trauma, but you know, the little T traumas. I'm like, I think psychedelic medicines have really important benefits for that as well.
It gets more subtle seemingly with the little T traumas where the nervous system constriction is less obvious. Is that the case?
Yeah. And I think when we talk about the little T traumas, you can be like highly functioning in 99% of your life, but then these little T traumas manifest in certain areas, whether it be with a romantic partnership or maybe when you're out in public and dealing with a social anxiety that feels like suddenly really acute. There's like really interesting pockets where that trauma can catch you. And I think that's where, we love to do work in that realm too. Like even if everything feels mostly grounded and regulated, I work a great job, my relationship is actually really healthy, but there are these moments where I notice I'm not myself and I regress and I move into like a lot of symptoms. I love targeting those areas and saying like, what is going on in here? Let's really kind of like bring the medicine and the awareness into those areas. And
so exciting. It's legal, right? It's amazing. And
it's unbelievable. Hopefully all of them soon. Oh,
yeah. If someone is wondering, should I go to Peru and do an ayahuasca retreat? Should I get into a MAP study and do MDMA? Should I grow some mushrooms in Jamaica, you know, or do ketamine? Like, I wanted to ask Rick this, but how do you think about that? There's all these different plant teachers or medicines.
Yeah, I kind of have like an esoteric answer to that, which is like, I think people get a call to one or the other. And that's where I think it's important. If you work with like an integration therapist or someone who has experience with psychedelic medicines, I think they can help you navigate the questions. And usually people get a spark and an idea of what medicine is likely going to be most helpful versus just trying to like figure it out on your own and just kind of guess or like read Arrowhead or a website, really bringing it to someone who's kind of worked with different medicines and helping them kind of help you discover your intention. And then I usually feel like there's something emerges, a call emerges to one medicine.
Mm.
So yeah, that's what I would say.
Yeah. I got the image of like a medicine man or woman there that you go to and consult.
Yeah. You spin the wheel.
And wherever it stops is what you're meant to do.
Yeah. I mean, I think ayahuasca is such a potent and beautiful medicine. So if people have the resources to go and work with traditional indigenous groups, Shipibo groups, they are just the most profound healers I've ever seen, to be honest. And
we've both been to the temple of the Way of Light, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would imagine your experience was as eye-opening as mine and just watching them work. Unreal.
I think I told this story already, but I can't remember if I did on the podcast or not, but I was projecting for the first three ceremonies. I think I told you in our conversation.
Yeah, we connected about this.
You had a similar. So I was projecting. I thought the whole thing was BS and was ready to leave and was like, what am I doing down here? I spent all this money. I came down here and everything is busted about this experience. Mm-hmm. And then I talked to to Michael, who or Matthew, who owns the place. And he told me I was projecting and that I should go back to my mat and just try and feel whatever it was I wasn't feeling. And I did that and had this incredible awakening and then purging and feeling like I was a dirty dish sponge that had been wrung out for the first time in my life.
Yeah. It reminds me of the earlier question when we talked about now being an altered state and like, what can we learn? Just that, like Matthew giving you that reflection of like, you know, my awareness is out here. I'm not trusting anything. And he just says, go in and feel what's, I feel like that suggestion, whew, simple and so profound, you know? And then the things that open for you when you got that invitation to go in and it's like, okay, that's where the things break open. Yeah, and I'm exactly in the same boat. My awareness will go out when I feel, you know, I'll always be skeptical of the environment. Like, what the hell is going on here? I don't know. You know, and what about those leaders? I don't know. And then just the invitation of like, wait a second, let me check in with myself. What's going on in here? I resonate with that. Yeah.
You talked in one of your articles about psychedelic maturity.
Hmm.
And I wanted to ask you about that. Like, what is psychedelic maturity in your view?
Yeah, that's, I think of it not working from impulse, working from experience, and doing the emotional labor it takes to ask yourself questions and actually answer with the truth. So like, why do I want to work with a psychedelic right now? If I'm really honest with myself, what is coming up? Do I want to tune out a little bit? Do I want a refresher? What actually is going on? And actually taking the time to ask that question. Maybe you get an answer and you actually bring it to like a reliable, trusted friend who can reflect back to you and say like, hey, actually, it feels like probably now isn't a good time for my reflection of you. I think all that emotional labor and work to really explore yourself to me is like psychedelic maturity. Whereas I feel like the other side is kind of like this impulsive, you know, wake up one morning, things don't feel good. I kind of want a refresher. So I take, you know, 100 micrograms of LSD pretty quickly, no intention. It's a very quick, can be very mindless in a lot of ways. And to me, yeah, psychedelic maturity is just, yeah, doing the work it takes to explore intention, to utilize set and setting in a way that's really beneficial, to engage it in a healing way. I think all those things is kind of what I consider psychedelic maturity.
Yeah. And I wonder, you know, we grew up with the drug war and the just say no, and here, this is your brain on drugs. Like, I remember those images of the eggs frying in the pan.
Yeah, I remember that.
So it's taken something for me to leave that behind and have my own experiences and come to this in a more mature way, which is still a work in progress. Do you think that that's different now for people that are coming into psychedelics for the first time?
Different in the sense of like not getting that old indoctrination.
Yeah. Or is that still there? Like do people come into the clinic, you know, terrified of ketamine?
It's so funny because I feel like the clients that are later into, I think past their 30s into their 40s have that old like, oh, is this dangerous? Is this okay? Is this illegal?
Is this going to put holes in my brain?
Yeah. But that like the shock and even shame of like, taking drugs. And I feel like the younger contingent, because I work with people that are under the age of 18 as well. And, you know, they seem to be way more open. And I think they've been exposed to a lot more of the evidence that's now available that psychedelic medicines are very powerful therapeutic tools and that there's a lot of proof of this. And I mean, if you deepen into even a tiny bit of the research, you see like, wow, this has a lot of benefit for a lot of different things. That wasn't available when I was young. I didn't know the MAP studies and, you know, it just wasn't available. So I'd say, yeah, the younger contingent do have less of a shame response to the medicines and I think you have less fear and just more trust in their therapeutic capacity.
Yeah, beautiful.
It's great to see it. It's beautiful to see it.
You know, even just calling them medicines is something that's new to me. They were drugs for so long and then drugs are bad and, you know, the whole thing.
Yeah. Well, the t-shirt said like, don't do drugs. It's pretty clear. Wait a second. All drugs? Wait, what's going on here?
Yeah. Meanwhile, the pharmaceutical industry, you know, is doing its thing.
Oh, don't even get me started with that. So bringing psychedelics into addiction, one of the biggest taboos we run into is why would you give addicts drugs? Right. And I say, first of all, they're already taking drugs that will likely kill them. B, a lot of people who go through recovery are utilizing drugs, antidepressants, anti-anxiety medications. Those are drugs, you know, so we just have another one that's available that happens to be psychedelic and, you know. I could go all day about that taboo.
Yeah, well, let's go a little bit on it. I mean, what else? What do you think the solution is?
In terms of working with that?
Yeah.
I think it's a time thing. Like you said, we got indoctrinated in a very interesting way culturally. And I think I think people are becoming way more hip to the idea that the war on drugs is kind of bullshit. And if you want to talk about it, like actually particularly stigmatizing and working towards marginalized groups, it appears to be related to that too. And I think the more the awareness comes up,
racism.
Like this is actually part of a systemic issue we're trying to delete and work with. I think the more we get in that territory, the more invitation we have to view psychedelic medicines, not as drugs, but as medicines. And to me, it's time and awareness and advocacy. I think people, clinicians, people who are doing powerful work coming out and promoting these, I think that's what's really going to shift the paradigm in a big way. And success stories. Those help.
Success stories.
Yeah.
I mean, the success stories that you told already are incredible. What's that like? You know, somebody who's who comes in, they've been an alcoholic for a decade or longer, and then in 8 weeks, they've had this spiritual awakening.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's so funny because I worked with someone who's a therapist. She says, well, I guess I need to like change my complete orientation now to start using this because I've never felt something shift me that quick and that powerfully. So that's a big thing. And a lot of people, I think, at the end of the treatments will be like, you have no idea. I'm like, I know. It's unbelievable. You know, when you see that kind of rapid growth and the quote unquote, like 10 years of therapy in a couple weeks, I think everyone has this like, whoa, this is available. And I think as clinicians now we're like, yeah, this is available. This is unreal.
Wow.
I'm still shocked. You know, I'm like, wow, yeah.
Wow. And do you think it sounds like it's the amalgam of the container that you guys create and the medicine and the therapy and the integration and the preparation. It's like it's all of it together that is required to produce those kind of results.
Totally. Yeah. You nailed it. Yeah. It's like preparation, setting intentions, which to me is fueled by the bravery of a client coming in and saying, I want to work on myself, which to me is like the first seed of how people heal is the ability to say yes to it. And then to step into the territory of like, this might be hard, but I'm going to do it anyway. You know, coming in for psychedelic sessions is kind of scary, a fear-inducing process. And the willingness to say yes to that, I feel like that already does a lot of the work because it changes. I'm moving away from my suffering to I'm moving towards it. And that alone, I feel like, is an unbelievable process. Sometimes I feel like I can just give someone a tic-tac after they set that intention and they'll blow open. So it's that. It's this dynamic relationship between a therapist and a client, creating so much safety, rapport, that overall healing container. And then, you put the medicine in and it just, I think those things in combination are just, it's an unbelievable combo.
Yeah. And the difference that I see there between that and talk therapy is it feels more vulnerable to me to go into somewhere like the Ketamine Collective and take something that's going to put me in an altered state. I'm not going to necessarily have my defense mechanisms and the things, my sense of myself. Like there's a surrender there that I haven't experienced as much in talk therapy, or it takes way longer, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. What
do you think?
Yeah, no, I agree. I just think of like the nervous system. I always refer to the nervous system and just kind of the body and how long it can take to feel safety in a therapy session, even when you can speak cognitively about what's going on. The actual activation in the body, it can take quite a bit of time for someone to feel really regulated enough to bring everything. And I think that's a nice thing about these medicines is like they do some of that work for us. And I think some people say like, oh, well, isn't that cheating? To me, it's like, no, it's giving the body reference to what it can do. And yeah, I mean, so long as you trust the provider you're working with and you develop some safety, enough safety, I think that's the beautiful thing. It's a great space to drop into that and to be vulnerable and to trust. And like you said, surrender. Whew.
Yeah, the surrender. I mean, that's step three, right, of the 12 steps.
Yeah, mandatory.
Mandatory.
The healing process.
And then into the shit, straight into the...
Yeah. To weigh it in.
Yeah. What's the future here that we should be working towards with ketamine and ketamine-assisted psychotherapy? Is this something that we can bring for the betterment of well people? I think Rick said that to me. Yeah, what do you think the future is that we should be heading towards?
Yeah, that's a great, good question. The first thing that stands out to me is reputation. So ketamine still carries some of the stigma. And I would say, a large portion of the people that I speak to about ketamine still have this sense of like, what? No, not ketamine. So success stories and just people continuing to promote and advocate for the efficacy of ketamine feels like a big piece, working with the stigma. But I love this idea too. yes, we bring it to the people that are really stuck, the treatment-resistant depression, the areas where people have tried a lot of treatment and it hasn't worked. And we use ketamine kind of as this, you know, final attempt. And also optimizing humanity, you know, and people with the little T traumas that know they have some areas where they want to feel growth and wellness. I feel like having it available to that too, with the overall intention of like utilizing psychedelic medicines as a way to open the heart, help people heal trauma, which to me just initiates more desire to be of service to the world, to be connected to the world, to bring levity to the world. And that to me is, if you want to talk about overall intention, is like to soften everybody up, you know, and to open everybody up.
Loosen
to,
us off.
Just like shake off some of the shit that we've carried for so long and, you know, get the heart open and feel a lot safer with each other. And, you know, let the love bust through. Maybe that's a little woo-woo, but that's my dream. It's just like, let's soften everybody up. Get everyone in their hearts and their bodies.
Yeah, I mean, who wants to go to war and either risk getting killed or kill other people? It feels to me like there has to be a disconnection for someone to want to do that.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the overall view, not just ketamine specifically, to have all these tools available as healing resources, the psilocybins, the MDMAs, the ayahuascas. To me, that's going to be a really powerful thing when I think healers and therapists and people who are trained to work in this way have the availability of all the tools to work with people. And it's not, we're not hitting into these legal boundaries and we're just permitted to heal people. That's going to be I'll jump for joy when we hit that part.
Yeah. So it sounds like, you know, a big part of step one is getting rid of the stigma, education, spreading awareness that these are incredible medicines. And then what else? Is it just clinics all over and integrating this into, like, I love the rite of passage idea and getting this into our culture for young people when they're 16 or 18 or 21 or whatever it is.
Yeah, I love that idea. Yeah, I think having clinics available, finding ways for people to get skillfully trained. I always look at indigenous groups too. I feel like they've been doing this work so powerfully and so profoundly with psychedelic medicines for so long. And if you look, they have deep apprenticeships. They work with medicines for a very long time. They get to know them very deeply and passionately. They know where to bring them, where not to bring them. And they develop communities of healers that know how to work with these medicines in very profound ways. And people train and learn how to work with them. And then it stays in the culture. And to me, that would be my ideal. If we just find a way to copy what has already been very successful in so many different indigenous groups throughout the world with psychedelic medicines. And contextualizing them in spiritual ways, I think, is very powerful. And, you know, like you said, rite of passage, like finding areas where it's really important to bring these medicines on board. I think of adolescence to adulthood is like a really potent time. It's my first big psychedelic experience was adolescence, and it
Me too.
Radically changed my life. Yeah.
What was your experience?
I worked with psilocybin when I must have been 16 with my twin brother, a close friend, and we just took mushrooms in the home with the intention of like, let's just have some fun. And I mean, it was like a deeply opening experience. One of those like, wow, I'll never see the world again. Or the same way as I saw it before, like doors have been opened that can't close. And just the profundity and awareness and specialness of being alive. That was the message of like, wow, this is amazing to be alive. Yeah. And that never shut. And it stayed with me.
I had similar experiences on mushrooms and MDMA, and which was called ecstasy then. You don't hear that much anymore.
Yeah. They're good old days. Yeah, they certainly open up a lot. And what a pregnant time to be influenced in that way as an adolescent, because it can be like a pretty confusing area.
Oh, it's
of life.
So confusing.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden to have this opening of, I think it can give so much context. And it even pointed me in the direction of being of service and wanting to be a therapist. I really attribute early mushroom experiences to that. Yeah.
It's so confusing in our culture in adolescence. And I think a lot of, like, we've lost a lot of the elders that traditionally would help people at that stage of life orient to moving into adulthood and into maturity. And it seems like the more superheroes, like to use your term, people who've done their own work and got to the other side, well, those people can then help shepherd the younger generation or just people, other people through the process.
Yeah, well said. And again, makes me think of the 12th step, the final step being service and coming back to the 12. Beginning to help. Yeah, to me, I think that's how humanity should work. I think that's what we're programmed for, you know, move through our stuff and then reach a hand back out and help people clear through their own stuff. I think that's
what's so beautiful for me about the 12 steps is it's, And I always thought that the 12 steps was preachy God program for alcoholics. That was my view until about a year ago. Mm-hmm. And now I realize that all those references to God were because of the time that it was created at, that fit into the culture. And actually the reference to God could be anything, could be spirit, could be nature, could be just other people. It's open-ended.
Yeah, the door is wide open for how you relate to the spiritual component. But again, like you said, like the stigma or the ideas that we carry into these modalities, that once we get in them, we're like, wait a second, this is really profound. I think that's, we have so much history with different forms and modalities that are really profound that get all this bullshit off the front until you step in. And it could be ketamine, it could be 12-step. Until you step in, you're like, oh, this is just deep personal work. That's what this is, you know, and right. I can actually relate to it the way I'd like to relate to it. It's not, you know, yeah. Which I love, by the way, that you stepped into it, even though you had some notion of, yeah, whatever it was, the willingness to step in. That to me, again, is such a big piece of this work.
I mean, it wouldn't have been, it was because somebody close to me was showing a transformation that couldn't be denied.
See, that feels potent too. Like as we do our work and as things open up, that naturally I think inspires people to become inquisitive. Like what do you do? You know, you seem a little happier, more open or more equanimous. What's going on in there? You know, and then they finger point to where they're, that to me is really,
that's like, cool. There's the path.
Yeah. This is what we're
like, all right, here. I'll check that out. That sounds cool.
Yeah. It reminds me in the 12 step meetings, they say like, find someone who has what you want. And ask them how they did it. That could be it.
Yeah. Yeah. Beautiful. What else? What else do you want to let people know or discuss?
I mean, I still feel a lot of energy around the addiction stuff, if you don't mind me.
Let's do it, man. I'm so into that right now.
Yeah. I think that's where actually I feel the most passion. And if you want to talk about entrance point, I mean, it's where I feel like I want to bring a lot of my energy. I was like reading statistics before we did this, and I think it's close to 600,000 people die from drug-related causes in the world. 1 in 4 of those are in the United States, which is unreal. And then 64,000 of those are overdoses that are considered preventable deaths. So we are in like an absolute crisis.
This is every year?
This is every year in the United States, 64,000 overdose alone, yeah. Considered preventable deaths. So, I mean, this is a rampant crisis. And at least my stance as a psychotherapist, I'm kind of like a by any means necessary. If that's the truth of the case that we are losing this many people, and it's reflected in my personal experience, when I'm working in residential treatment, you see clients passing away consistently. They're 22, 24, 26-year-old heroin addicts, methamphetamine addicts that are dying young. And it's, to me, it's just not okay in any way. And I want to do whatever it takes to prevent that, because I've seen when people recover and become the superheroes, these are people we need. And it's a fucking shame if we don't have them in our world, particularly when they're healed. So to me, I'm like, that's where I feel the most motivation of like, if psychedelic therapy helps people in active addiction, I'm bringing it to active addiction. And I don't care about the taboos. And I know it's scary. And sometimes it might not work. Sometimes it will work. If it does work, I'm willing to go in there. And I think that attitude, we kind of need to adopt that attitude, at least with addiction, and stop being so tense. And in some ways, I mean, some part of the 12-step model is a very abstinence only. To me, I'm like, I want to kick all that to the curb and say, like, we need to heal people and we need to do what it takes to heal people.
Bill W., the founder, I think it was Bill W., the founder of AA, he got into LSD back in the day and was trying to integrate it into the program. And I guess the people in the program said, hell no.
Yeah.
It's the last thing we want to do. But that really knit together these two worlds for me, that he had that same discovery that, you know, that you're working in and that other people are working in.
Yeah. Well, I think what he saw is what we see as clinicians. Like, he had a deep spiritual experience. I think he was in acute withdrawal from alcohol, which, you want to talk about a psychedelic experience, it gets pretty gnarly in there, which created some of the path for the 12 steps. So it was through like a visionary state that he opened up the idea of the 12 steps. And then I think when he found LSD, he said, oh, wow, you know, here's another way that you can open spiritual experience and get inspired and actually move through healing. Yeah. And the same kind of idea of like, well, that's, you know, that's not the real way to do it. And you're using a medicine to get there. That's, you know, that doesn't count. And to me, I want to just like strip that away and just say like, these experiences are very real and they register in the body and they leave imprints that don't leave. I feel that personally as someone who's worked with psychedelics, I see it with my clients. To call it false or to call it whatever, drug induced, I just don't agree with that logic. It's just when we clear a lot of our stuff and we open in that kind of way, these are like real, raw, true experiences we're having that are unavoidable, and they're deep and they're powerful, and they leave profound results. And to me, they should be respected and appreciated as like keys and tools to take us to that space. And then to learn how, I mean, we can do it without the medicines. That's true. But the medicine gives us a reference for what's available, which to me is very important to have the blueprint. And then integration therapy and, you know, seeking these experiences without the medicines, of course, but use the tools that are available, you know.
Yeah, why not, you
know?
Right?
Yeah, I'm not going to try to crack open something with my bare hands if I know I have a tool available to help me. Yeah, if I have a machete.
When you talked about losing like 65,000 people to overdose a year and then mentioned these are the most sensitive, these are sensitive, it's like our culture is systematically killing off the most sensitive among us. And that has me feeling revulsion and it's like, shit, that's not sustainable.
Totally. Yeah. They're the ones we need. Yeah. They're the ones we need. And yeah, I mean, even hearing you say that, I feel like a lot of heartbreak, you know, and this is just through addiction. I mean, there's other mental health illnesses that I think are a response to heightened sensitivity as well. And we need to learn how to like carve out a place for people that feel a lot. And we need to invite the willingness to feel a lot as opposed to whatever, turn off and distract. And I feel like so much of how we're coached and motivated as humans is to dull. And to me, I'm like, how do we increase the ability to like be vibrant, to feel a lot, to sense a lot, and carve out a space for that to be okay?
Yeah. How do we do that in our culture?
It's a great question.
It's a big question.
I hope we're doing it right now.
Yeah, I think we are. Mm-hmm. Feels like to some degree. So what else about addiction? Let's move into that. You said, talked about entry points.
Yeah. What else about addiction? Psychedelic medicines work. That's the big piece. Yeah. Sticks out for me.
And so there's inpatient treatments. I've had some friends do that. I think one was for an eating disorder and one was for bipolar was the diagnosis. But we've got this whole artifice of psychiatry that has hundreds of labels now that we're stamping people with. And then we're putting them on drugs that are supposed to help for those various labels. And the way that I kind of see it all now after doing the reading and doing this series on psychedelic healing is, well, trauma is kind of underneath it all, or not at all, but most of it, it seems, seemingly. And the way that you heal trauma is with somebody else and feeling it and processing it and moving through it.
Yeah, the attitude of moving towards is going to be ultimately what heals trauma, which is interesting. That, yeah, a lot of our therapeutic modalities around mitigating symptoms, which to me, mitigating a symptom is like a communication from the trauma that something's not okay. So to mitigate the things that are coming up that are saying like something's not right, it's kind of an interesting idea.
It's like the smoke alarm's going off and you unplug the smoke alarm.
Yeah. You find a way to like lower the volume.
Yeah, or stuff it with something.
Yeah, but the alarm's still going off. And that's, I mean, I have a lot of respect for traditional and conventional psychiatry and medications. They work wonderfully, particularly with the attitude of like, similar to what we do with ketamine, lessen the noise so we can go in and do the work that we need to do. But if it's simply to mitigate and to turn off and to try to live a dulled, tuned down life, ultimately, I don't know if that brings a lot of satisfaction in the long run. So at least with the psychedelic medicine work, the intention is like, let's go in, let's say yes to the difficulty. We'll go in, we'll not use a medicine to tap out, but tap in, and we'll go in and we'll see if we can like really profoundly shift and change what's in there. And a lot of that, again, is through the attitude of like saying yes to it, working with someone, you know, bringing in spiritual context, which I think is a big piece of what psychedelic medicines does. With the idea of like, we can actually resolve and bring resolution to a lot of this, or at least a new container in which to hold it versus just mitigating it and turning the volume down a little bit.
Yeah. And if this is like a rite of passage into a spiritual path, it seems like it's a lifelong process of moving into our trauma and being open about the things that are tripping us up or bringing us pain or suffering. It seems like it never ends. Like I had this view when I went down to Peru that I was going to be healed in, you know, 10 days done, you know, and now it seems like, oh, this is a path that I'll either be on or I won't be on for the rest of my life. And if I'm not on it, it means I'm not feeling my feelings.
Mm-hmm. But that's where I would ask you, do you feel like you could really not be on it now that you've opened it? I wonder.
I do. I mean, I feel like I can kind of check out for a week if I get really busy and I work that whole week and I don't take time to meditate and reconnect, that there can be this disconnection that happens for me. And I have to, like, the periods of disconnection seem to be getting shorter for me.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I always wonder. I feel like there's almost like a witnessing function now when you start the path of like, oop, I'm checked out, you know?
Yeah, right.
So now before, at least, yeah.
It wasn't conscious.
Yeah, yeah. They talk about it, say being unconsciously burdened and then becoming consciously burdened, which is like the awareness is up and now I'm watching the ways that I'm tuning out. And just like the different felt experience when you start seeing the ways you're doing the things you don't want to be doing. And it becomes way harder to tolerate that over long periods of time, you know? Which is why I asked you the question, because I'm like, sometimes I feel like even if you want to get away from it, it's like you kind of open a door you can't close in some ways.
Or I have that experience where now, like, sometimes I'm doing like mindless eating, and in my mind is, you're mindlessly eating. Are you like, you're doing this because you don't want to feel something?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like there in my head. So I totally can resonate with that.
Yeah. Yeah. I work with that same voice. I'm like, can we just, come on, just let me tune out a little bit, please.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm watching. I see you.
Pete Walker, he's an author, and he talks about endarkenment, like enlightenment versus darkenment. He says he assigns people endarkenment days because he's like, even your recovery needs a break. Like,
I love that idea. It reminds me of like cheat days for people that are on diets and things like that. Of like, let yourself. Yeah. They talk about it a lot in the Tibetan tradition in mindfulness too, of touch and go, giving ourselves the ability to like really drop in and touch into things that need to be examined and worked with, but also like, go distract yourself and take a fucking break. Yeah. And like, not every day needs to be deep, intensive healing work. You know, right. It could also be like sitting in the sun and doing a whole lot of nothing, reading whatever Tom Clancy books. I don't know.
Whatever that is.
Yeah. Yeah. But the ability to let the system rest. I definitely agree with that. I like the term endarkenment too. It just sounds good. It rolls off the tongue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you said we need these folks, like the most sensitive among us, like, and you seem touched when you said that, you know, can you tell us more about that?
Yeah. Well, I think they're the antithesis to, I think a lot of what we see in leadership right now is like lack of heart centering, lack of compassion, kind of like this like business mindset of like, let's just keep things moving and like leave the emotions to the side and let's just get shit done. And I think the antithesis to that is like, wait, a lot's happening. Can we slow down? There's a lot of things that are, you know, I think the highly sensitive person says like, whoa, time out. Everything feels really intense. Can we slow this down? And that attitude and that ability to feel and to put words to that, I think is so needed in this culture because we are just like whipping so fast and the feelers are like, holy shit, what is, you know, like holding on for dear life. And I think that pace that the highly sensitive person has is just such good medicine for our quick moving world. And something I felt too with quarantine was kind of this time out. And then all of a sudden the pace dropped. And I think the feelers were like, yeah, cool. I feel regulated now. And the people that are in the compulsive energy are, you know, scrambling and starting to really self-soothe in ways that the feelers were doing when the world was moving really fast. So just very interesting to see how when the pace slows, the people who feel a lot are like in a little bit more peace. Yeah, and I just think they're so valuable. They have so much to teach us. And to me, those are the people that need to be in leadership too. People that really encourage us to take a breath, slow down, feel things, and pay attention. There's so much wisdom in the body feeling things. And
yeah. I'm trying to think of leaders that exhibit that. It's pretty difficult for me right now. Yeah.
Not a lot come up for me.
Like the Dalai Lama maybe, or
yeah, I think of musicians, you know, people that are really speaking their experience and feeling a lot and it just transmutes through the music. These, I think that's where I feel really guided and inspired, even through the Black Lives Movement, like really listening to the poets and the artists and less so to the politicians and, you know, corporations, and more so like, who are the people that are really speaking from a heart feeling space? And to me, like the Talib Kweli's, the Commons, the Mos Defs that have been speaking to these dynamics poetically for a very long time. Those are the ones that hit my heart and I cry and I feel a lot. And then I hear the politicians speak from this, you know, kind of like type A cognitive. And I'm like, it doesn't resonate emotionally. And then the poet, I'm like, oof, oh, okay. That's the felt experience of a Black person in this world. Ooh, that registers deep. You know?
Yeah. It's like more art, less doing or less, yeah, yeah. less like achievement. And I think about like both the Democrats and the Republicans in the, the flavor or the feeling of the political process, it does feel so full on all the time, 110% charge forward. And it sounds like the sensitive people are the compass, and the compass, because the heart is ultimately the supreme compass. So we're moving ahead, but if we're not connected to that, then where are we going?
Yeah, we're like rhino blasting through
who knows what.
Yeah. And just causing a lot of damage in the way. I think that's, yeah. The highly sensitive person to me feels like the archetype of the shaman too, of someone who's holding this larger emotional, spiritual context that you can come in to feel the safe haven of going inward and feeling and healing and processing. I'm like, that's, I feel like they hold that gift for us in a big way.
I like that frame of like when you see an addict, you're more than likely seeing a very sensitive person or somebody who had a very specific life experience that is yet to be transmuted into a gift.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of the chaos you see, I mean, it's hard to be in relationship with an addict and to watch and not feel judgment. I still feel it all the time. Like, whoa, you know, you're enacting things that are really hard for me to deal with. And I feel like they're mirroring to us the chaos of what they feel being in this world. Do you know what I mean? Like they're just an embodiment and like bringing into behavior what it feels like to be in this world as a highly sensitive person, which is like, it feels like chaos. It feels completely out of control. It feels like you can't predict anything. I'm like, yeah, it's their felt experience. And they're just showing you what it feels like to be them. So I think just some way to get a compassionate view is like, it's less about this personal, this is just a bad person doing bad things, and more like, this is a person who's communicating what it feels like to be in their body. Mm. And the way they're showing it to you, you might not like.
Yeah.
This is the way they're coping with a world that is like very intense.
This is like the canary in the coal mine.
Yeah.
That sensitivity. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I still believe in holding people accountable. Even if you're, you know, a highly sensitive person in addiction, you know, if you're doing some reckless shit, you're still accountable to it. And I think we need to have a way of being a little bit more compassionate and understanding what they're mirroring to us. It reminds me too, in a family system, a kid that is acting out is usually speaking for the family system, and the acting out, we learn to translate it of they're communicating something to us about the system. And we could hyper-focus on the negative behavior and why they're doing that. And do they have a moral deficit? Or we could say, what are they communicating to us? That's really valuable to know about the system. And I feel like addicts, they teach us a lot about powerlessness, chaos, intensity.
Yeah.
The swirling nature of the world we're in.
Yeah. I love that frame. Well, Craig, this has been awesome.
Yeah, thank you so much for letting me rap about this stuff.
Yeah, super compelling and interesting, and I love your frame. I feel excited to maybe try this ketamine course at some point, and
and
hopefully people now have a more well-rounded view of what ketamine is and how it can be useful for all of us to heal.
Yeah, I hope so. And yeah, I'll leave some personal information. BoulderKetamineCollective.com. We invite people to just message us, ask us about ketamine in the process. So if you're curious and just want to know a little bit more about the medicine, reach out to us, talk to us. We love to advocate and educate the community. So I would love to hear, Will, if you jump in there, just to debrief and chat about your experience and what it feels like. So yeah, I'd love to touch base again.
Yeah, for sure. And your website, I was on it earlier.
Yeah, my personal website is CraigSalernoCounseling.com.
Yep.
Lists out some things about ketamine as well, FAQ and such, and talks a little bit about the treatment. And then our BoulderKetamineCollective.com website is more our big group.
Cool. And we'll have both of those in the show notes. So if anybody's listening, just check the show notes for those. Any final words or thoughts?
I think in the nature of talking about our current position in the world as ceremony, the reminder of this, you know, keep our eyes open, stay awake to what you're thinking and feeling, come inside, pay attention. That is really sticking out to me. It just feels like an important reminder for myself and for everyone listening. So
awesome. Yeah. Thank you for that reminder.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Will, for having me on. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Craig. Hey friends, it's Will again. Just a few more things before I sign off. I hope you enjoyed this episode. The first one is that this episode is brought to you by Fundraising Mastery, which is the fundraising accelerator that I launched earlier this year to help mission-driven founders raise seed capital. So if you're creating something or you know anybody in your network who's creating something impactful and they're looking for help getting the financing that's going to take their venture to the next level, please go to foundersgetfunded.com and I'd love to meet them. We're currently enrolling our next cohort and we've set a goal of 50% founders of color in that cohort. So if you can share that or help us find those people that are going to be the right match for this cohort, much appreciated. And then the last thing is we just broke 10 reviews on Apple Podcasts. So thank you if you left a review. But to anybody else listening, if you haven't left a review yet, they really do help us get more visibility in the podcast directory. They help more people find these conversations, learn about psychedelic healing, social impact business, and all the stuff that we talk about on the show. So it's my humble request that if you enjoy the show, please click on there. And even if you don't have an iPhone, I think you can still leave a review through the web. But just search for the podcast, click through and leave a review. Let us know what you think. And it'll help more people find this community. We also have a Facebook page called Evolving Earth. And it's private, I believe, right now. But you can search for it and find it. We'll put it in the show notes. And I would love to have you as a member of that community there. I'm trying to bring us together, all of us that are interested in the future and how we're going to create one that works for everybody. So sending you big love from Boulder, and we'll see you next time.